Chapter 35, Piercing the Veneer. Shortly after I returned home from Ecuador in 2003, the United States invaded Iraq for the second time in a little over a decade. The EHMs had failed. The Jackals had failed. So young men and women were sent to kill and die among the desert sands. One important question the invasion raised, but one that I figured few Americans would be in a position to consider, was what this would mean for the Royal House of Saud. If the United States took over Iraq, which, according to many estimates, has more oil than Saudi Arabia, there would seem to be little need to continue honoring the pact we struck with the Saudi royal family in the 1970s, the deal that originated with the Saudi Arabian money laundering affair. The end of Saddam, like the end of Noriega in Panama, would change the formula. In the case of Panama, once we had reinstated our puppets, we controlled the canal, regardless of the terms of the treaty Torrijos and Carter had negotiated. Once we controlled Iraq, then could we break OPEC? Would the Saudi royal family become irrelevant in the arena of global oil politics? A few pundits were already questioning why Bush attacked Iraq, rather than funneling all of our resources into pursuing Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Could it be that, from the point of view of this administration, this oil family, establishing oil supplies, as well as a justification for construction contracts, was more important than fighting terrorists? There also was another possible outcome, however. OPEC might attempt to reassert itself. If the United States took control of Iraq, the other petroleum-rich countries might have little to lose by raising oil prices and/or reducing supplies. This possibility tied in with another scenario, one with implications that would likely occur to few people outside the world of higher international finance, yet could tip the scales of the geopolitical balance and ultimately bring down the system the corporatocracy had worked so hard to construct. It could, in fact, turn out to be the single factor that would cause history's first truly global empire to self-destruct. In the final analysis, the global empire depends to a large extent on the fact that the dollar acts as the standard world currency, and that the United States Mint has the right to print those dollars. Thus, we make loans to countries like Ecuador with the full knowledge that they will never repay them. In fact, we do not want them to honor their debts, since the non-payment is what gives us our leverage, our pound of flesh. Under normal conditions, we would run the risk of eventually decimating our own funds. After all, no creditor can afford too many defaulted loans. However, ours are not normal circumstances. The United States prints currency that is not backed by gold. Indeed, it is not backed by anything other than a general, worldwide confidence in our economy and our ability to marshal the forces and resources of the empire we have created to support us. The ability to print currency gives us immense power. It means, among other things, that we can continue to make loans that will never be repaid, and that we ourselves can accumulate huge debts. By the beginning of 2003, the United States' national debt exceeded a staggering $6 trillion, and was projected to reach $7 trillion before the end of the year, roughly $24,000 for each U.S. citizen. Much of this debt is owed to Asian countries, particularly to Japan and China, who purchase U.S. Treasury securities, essentially IOUs, with funds accumulated through sales of consumer goods, including electronics, computers, automobiles, appliances, and clothing goods, to the United States and the worldwide market. As long as the world accepts the dollar as its standard currency, this excessive debt does not pose a serious obstacle to the corporatocracy. However, if another currency should come along to replace the dollar, and if some of the United States' creditors, Japan or China, for example, should decide to call in their debts, the situation would change drastically. The United States would suddenly find itself in a most precarious situation. In fact, today the existence of such a currency is no longer hypothetical. The euro entered the international financial scene on January 1, 2002, and is growing in prestige and power with every passing month. The euro offers an unusual opportunity for OPEC if it chooses to retaliate for the Iraq invasion, or if for any other reason it decides to flex its muscles against the United States. A decision by OPEC to substitute the euro for the dollar as its standard currency would shake the empire to its very foundations. If that were to happen, and if one or two major creditors were to demand that we repay our debts in euros, the impact would be enormous. I had these things on my mind on the morning of Good Friday, April 18, 2003, as I walked the short distance from my house to the converted garage that serves as my office, sat down at the desk, turned on the computer, and, as usual, went to the New York Times website. The headline leaped out at me. It immediately transported me from my thoughts about the new realities of international finance, the national debt, and euros, back to that of my old profession. U.S. gives Bechtel a major contract in rebuilding Iraq. The article stated, "The Bush administration awarded the Bechtel Group of San Francisco the first major contract today in a vast reconstruction plan for Iraq." Farther down the page, the authors informed readers that the Iraqis will then work with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, institutions in which the United States enjoys wide influence, to reshape the country. Wide influence? There was an understatement. I linked to another Times article, "Company has ties in Washington and to Iraq." I skipped through the first several paragraphs, which repeated much of the information from the previous article, and came to, "Bechtel has long-standing ties to the national security establishment. One director is George P. Shultz, who was Secretary of State under President Ronald Reagan. Before joining the Reagan administration, Mr. Shultz, who also serves as a senior counselor to Bechtel, was the company's president, working alongside Caspar W. Weinberger, who served as an executive at the San Francisco-based company before his appointment as defense secretary. This year, President Bush appointed Bechtel's chief executive, Riley P. Bechtel, to serve on the President's Export Council." Here in these articles was the story of modern history, the drive to global empire, in a nutshell. What was going on in Iraq and described in the morning press was the result of the work Claudine had trained me to do some 35 years before, and of the work of other men and women who shared a lust for self-aggrandizement not unlike the one I had known. It marked the current point of the corporatocracy's progress along the road to bringing every person in the world under its influence. These articles were about the 2003 invasion of Iraq, and about the contracts now being signed, both to rebuild that country from the wreckage created by our military, and to build anew in the mold of the modern, westernized model. Yet, without saying so, the news of April 18, 2003 also harked back to the early 1970s and the Saudi Arabian money laundering affair. SAMA and the contracts flowing out of it had established new and irrevocable precedents that allowed, indeed mandated, U.S. engineering and construction companies and the petroleum industry to co-opt the development of a desert kingdom. In the same mighty blow, SAMA established new rules for the global management of petroleum, redefined geopolitics, and forged with the Saudi royal family an alliance that would ensure their hegemony as well as their commitment to playing by our rules. As I read those articles, I could not help but wonder how many other people knew, as I did, that Saddam would still be in charge if he had played the game as the Saudis had. He would have his missiles and chemical plants. We would have built them for him, and our people would be in charge of upgrading and servicing them. It would be a very sweet deal, even as Saudi Arabia had been. Until now, the mainstream media had been careful not to publicize this story, but today, here it was. True, it was a mere inkling. The articles were only the meekest ghosts of a summary, yet the story seemed to be emerging. Wondering if the New York Times was taking a maverick stance, I visited the CNN website and read, "Bechtel wins Iraq contract." The CNN story was very similar to the one in the Times, except it added, "Several other companies have at various times been reported as possible competitors for the job, either as primary bidders or as parts of teams, including the Kellogg Brown & Root, KBR, unit of Halliburton Company, of which Vice President Dick Cheney once was CEO. Already, Halliburton has won a contract which could be worth $7 billion and could last up to 2 years to make emergency repairs to Iraq's oil infrastructure." The story of the march to global empire did indeed appear to be leaking out. Not the details, not the fact that it was a tragic story of debt, deception, enslavement, exploitation, and the most blatant grab in history for the hearts, minds, souls, and resources of people around the world. Nothing in these articles hinted that the story of Iraq in 2003 was the continuation of a shameful story. Nor did they disclose that this story, as old as empire, has now taken on new and terrifying dimensions, both because of its magnitude during this time of globalization and because of the subtlety with which it is executed. Despite its shortfalls, however, the story did appear to be leaking out, almost reluctantly. The idea of the reluctant story leaking out hit very close to home. It reminded me of my own personal story and of the many years I had postponed telling it. I had known for a very long time that I had a confession to make. Still, I postponed making it. Thinking back, I see that my doubts, the whisperings of guilt, were there from the beginning. They had started in Claudine's apartment, even before I made the commitment to go to Indonesia on that first trip, and they had haunted me almost incessantly all these years. I also knew that had the doubts, the pain, and the guilt not constantly nagged me, I would never have gotten out. Like so many others, I would have been stuck. I would not have stood on a beach in the Virgin Islands and decided to quit Maine. Yet, I was still deferring, just as we as a culture continue to defer. These headlines seem to hint at the alliance between big corporations, international banks, and governments. But like my main resume, the stories barely touched the surface. It was a gloss. The real story had little to do with the fact that the major engineering and construction firms were once again receiving billions of dollars to develop a country in our image, among a people who, in all likelihood, had no desire to reflect that image. Or that an elite band of men was repeating an age-old ritual of abusing the privileges of their high government positions. That picture is just too simple. It implies that all we need to do, if we decide to right the wrongs of the system, is to throw these men out. It feeds into the conspiracy theories, and thereby provides a convenient excuse to turn on the TV and forget about it all, comfortable in our third-grade view of history, which runs, "They will take care of it. The ship of state is seaworthy and will get nudged back on course. We may have to wait for the next election, but all will turn out for the best." The real story of modern empire, of the corporatocracy that exploits desperate people and is executing history's most brutal, selfish, and ultimately self-destructive resource grab, has little to do with what was exposed in the newspapers that morning, and has everything to do with us. And that, of course, explains why we have such difficulty listening to the real story. We prefer to believe the myth that thousands of years of human social evolution has finally perfected the ideal economic system, rather than to face the fact that we have merely bought into a false concept and accepted it as gospel. We have convinced ourselves that all economic growth benefits humankind, and that the greater the growth, the more widespread the benefits. Finally, we have persuaded one another that the corollary to this concept is valid and morally just, that people who excel at stoking the fires of economic growth should be exalted and rewarded, while those born at the fringes are available for exploitation. This concept and its corollary are used to justify all manner of piracy. Licenses are granted to rape and pillage and murder innocent people in Iran, Panama, Colombia, Iraq, and elsewhere. EHMs, jackals, and armies flourish for as long as their activities can be shown to generate economic growth, and they almost always demonstrate such growth, thanks to the biased sciences of forecasting, econometrics, and statistics. If you bomb a city and then rebuild it, the data shows a huge spike in economic growth. The real story is that we are living a lie. Like my main resume, we have created a veneer that hides the fatal cancers beneath the surface. Those cancers are exposed by the X-rays of our statistics, which disclose the terrifying fact that history's most powerful and wealthiest empire has outrageously high rates of suicide, drug abuse, divorce, child molestation, rape, and murder, and that, like a malignant cancer, these afflictions spread their tentacles in an ever-widening radius every year. In our hearts, each of us feels the pain. We cry out for change. Yet we slam our fists to our mouths, stifling those cries, and so we go unheard. It would be great if we could just blame it all on a conspiracy, but we cannot. The empire depends on the efficacy of big banks, corporations, and governments, the corporatocracy. But it is not a conspiracy. This corporatocracy is ourselves. We make it happen, which, of course, is why most of us find it difficult to stand up and oppose it. We would rather glimpse conspirators lurking in the shadows, because most of us work for one of those banks, corporations, or governments, or in some way are dependent on them for the goods and services they produce and market. We cannot bring ourselves to bite the hand of the master who feeds us. That is the situation I was pondering as I sat staring at the headlines on the screen of my computer, and it raised a number of questions. How do you rise up against a system that appears to provide you with your home and car, food and clothes, electricity and health care, even when you know that the system also creates a world where 24,000 people starve to death each day, and millions more hate you, or at least hate the policies made by representatives you elected? How do you muster the courage to step out of line and challenge concepts you and your neighbors have always accepted as gospel, even when you suspect that the system is ready to self-destruct? Slowly, I stood up and headed back to the house to pour myself another cup of coffee. I took a short detour and picked up my copy of the Palm Beach Post, lying near the mailbox beside our driveway. It had the same Bechtel Iraq article, copyrighted by the New York Times. But now I noticed the date on the masthead, April 18th. It is a famous date, at least in New England, instilled in me by my Revolutionary War-minded parents and by Longfellow's poem. Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere on the 18th of April in 75. Hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. This year, Good Friday happened to fall on the anniversary of Paul Revere's ride. Seeing that date on the front page of the Post made me think of the colonial silversmith racing his horse through the dark streets of New England towns, waving his hat and shouting, "The British are coming!" Revere had risked his life to spread the word, and loyal Americans responded. They stopped the empire, back then. I wondered what had motivated them, why those colonial Americans were willing to step out of line. Many of the ringleaders had been prosperous. What had inspired them to risk their businesses, to bite the hand that fed them, to risk their lives? Each of them undoubtedly had personal reasons, and yet there must have been some unifying force, some energy or catalyst, a spark that ignited all those individual fires at that single moment in history. And then it came to me. Words. The telling of the real story about the British Empire and its selfish and ultimately self-destructive mercantile system had provided that spark. The exposure of the underlying meaning, through the words of men like Tom Paine and Thomas Jefferson, fired the imaginations of their countrymen, opened hearts and minds. The colonists began to question, and when they did, they discovered a new reality that cut away at the deceits. They discerned the truth behind the patina, understood the way the British Empire had manipulated, deceived, and enslaved them. They saw that their English masters had formulated a system and then had managed to convince most people of a lie, that it was the best system mankind could offer, that the prospects for a better world depended on channeling resources through the King of England, that an imperial approach to commerce and politics was the most efficient and humane means of helping the majority of the people, when in fact the truth was that the system enriched only a very few at the expense of the many. This lie and the resulting exploitation endured and expanded for decades, until a handful of philosophers, businessmen, farmers, fishermen, frontiersmen, writers, and orators began to speak the truth. Words. I thought about their power as I refilled my coffee cup, walked back to my office, and returned to the computer. I logged off the CNN website and brought up the file I had been working on the night before. I read the last paragraph I had written. This story must be told. We live in a time of terrible crisis and tremendous opportunity. The story of this particular economic hitman is the story of how we got to where we are, and why we currently face crises that seem insurmountable. This story must be told, because only by understanding our past mistakes will we be able to take advantage of future opportunities. Most importantly, this story must be told because today, for the first time in history, one nation has the ability, the money, and the power to change all this. It is the nation where I was born, and the one I served as an EHM, the United States of America. This time, I would not stop. The coincidences of my life and the choices I had made around them had brought me to this point. I would move forward. I thought again of that other man, that lone rider galloping through the dark New England countryside, shouting out his warning. The silversmith knew that the words of Paine and Jefferson had preceded him, that people had read those words in their homes and discussed them in the taverns. Paine had pointed out the truth about the tyranny of the British Empire. Jefferson had proclaimed that our nation was dedicated to the principles of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And Revere, riding through the night, understood that men and women throughout the colonies had been empowered by those words. They would rise up and fight for a better world. Words. I made my decision to stop procrastinating, to finish, finally, what I had started so many times over all those years, to come clean, to confess, to write the words in this book.